Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, from the beautiful new film Duck, writer-director Nick Bedauer and legendary character actor Philip Baker Hall, plus multi-talented actress, playwright, author of the new book The Way of the Story, Catherine Ann Jones. It's all coming up next on tonight's episode of Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everyone. We're so pleased to bring you tonight's show. It's going to be a great one. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening, and Jerry is here with us, too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what is going on?
Jerry is manning our chat room. We have lots of listeners.
I'm manning the chat room. All our good friends are in there, so that's good.
Lots of listeners in the chat room. If you're listening tonight, you can log on to the chat room where you can converse with other movie fans. You can submit your questions through the chat room. And, of course, you can call in live to the show, too, at 718-508-9477. But we find that quite a few people are shy, and they like to stay in the chat room. And you know, we can't blame them for that. So
I can't blame them for that, but we're really not intimidating, not at all. I just don't get it. I don't get it anymore.
I know. It's great to bring you the show tonight. You know, Jerry, I don't know if you do know this because I discussed it with you earlier. I was diagnosed with bronchitis this morning. And what a great time to come down with that.
Yeah.
So if I start hacking uncontrollably, Jerry has all the tools and skills to take over right away. So
yeah, but it's what I had back in December for a couple of weeks. So
it's going around.
It is. I don't know what it is, but yeah.
But my voice sounds pretty.
Your voice sounds much better.
Yeah,
than mine
you.
Did.
Those yeah, very sexy quality too. Yeah.
Yeah, your voice sounds a lot better than mine did.
Just to let everyone know, you can subscribe to our show for free through iTunes. You can download every previous show, including we've had great ones. Our last show was a tribute to Alan J. Pakula. We've interviewed the screenwriter of Zodiac, John Sayles, Brian De Palma, just a wealth of terrific programming.
Just this year alone already, we've done the last two shows have been incredible.
It's amazing. And if you're a movie fan, this is the place for you, honestly. If you have a love for the art form, this is your show. We thank everyone for joining us tonight, and are you ready to get started?
I'm ready.
Okay, Duck tells the story of a recently widowed homeless man who is saved from the brink of suicide after forming the most unlikely of connections with a duck. Yes, you heard that right. Duck is the brainchild of writer-director Nick Bedauer, an extremely gifted filmmaker whose previous feature film effort was 1998's romantic comedy Zack and Reba. With Duck, Ms. Bedauer delivers a beautifully open-hearted film that inspires both honest tears and joy, while at the same time subtly exposing a government and a culture that carries less and less regard for its disenfranchised. Central to the film's effectiveness is its powerhouse lead performance from one of our greatest actors, Philip Baker Hall. Over the past 40 years, Mr. Hall has crafted an exceptional career on stage, film, and television. He electrified audiences and critics with his tour de force performance as Richard Nixon in Robert Altman's film Secret Honor, and later skyrocketed with a stunning trio of performances in Paul Thomas Anderson's Hard Eight, Boogie Nights, and Magnolia. And just take a listen to some of these other terrific films that grace his resume. Midnight Run, Air Force One, The Truman Show, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Rules of Engagement, Dogville, In Good Company, and of course Zodiac, our favorite film of last year.
Yes.
In addition, he has enjoyed over 200 guest roles on some of our most beloved series, including Timeless Turns in both Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome both Nick Bedauer and Philip Baker Hall to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Hall and Ms. Bedauer, are you both with us?
I'm here.
Hey, Philip.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, Jamie. Hey,
hi, Jamie.
It's great to have you both with us. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to discuss this film with you. It's such a gorgeous little film, and it moved me so much. Maybe let's start out with you, Nick. If you could tell me about the origins of the film, because you seem to have drawn inspiration for it from a series of personal experiences, didn't you?
Yeah, usually my ideas come from a moment in real life, because I love documentaries the most, actually. And
yeah.
This idea came to me when I was living at MacArthur Park, which is this kind of raucous, sprawling urban park in the middle of Los Angeles, and I was working at a homeless shelter and going to grad school, and they closed the park because it was at a time when they were closing a lot of public parks, and it was a really bad time for crime and crack and AIDS and you name it, and they
yeah.
shuttered the whole thing and kicked out all the homeless people and the ducks. And I found myself coming back each evening after class and watching it from my balcony and wondering where all the homeless guys who I knew and the ducks, which I knew too, because that's where I used to walk around when I had writer's block,
sure.
where they were all going to go. And it was this strange image of this man and this duck looking for a life in Los Angeles in a world where their lives were no longer valued that kind of stuck with me. So that was the core of the idea, and Duck is the cautionary tale slash urban fable that I ended up creating around that.
Did once that inspiration hit you, did it come out fairly quickly, I mean, in script form?
I didn't write the script for a long time, actually. And so the script is informed by a lot of things that have happened since, both politically and personally, like weird jobs I've had whilst trying to work in the film industry as well. So I didn't write it till years later, but then when I did write it, I sat down and started writing it, and it did happen pretty quickly. I wrote it fairly quickly as kind of a response to the war, and pretty much started pre-production the day I finished writing it, because I didn't really expect anyone to finance it at a company per se. So
yeah, I want to talk to you, I want to talk to you about the struggles of financing the film, but Mr. Hall, I'm sure that you see many scripts come through your desk, but what struck you about this particular one when it came your way?
Well, excuse me, I have a little bronchitis going myself. I'm on intimate terms with Mr. Bronchitis, but what really struck me about this script, other than than how gracefully it was written, and there's a kind of an elegance in the writing and the characterizations, as delineated by Nick, that I love. But what really kind of arrested my interest here, we've seen a lot of films, buddy films, as it were, over the years, whether it's with a central character and an animal, and there have been a number of those, charming and sentimental films.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the conventional buddy film, normally with two men, occasionally two women. But what's different about this film is it is not only an explanation of character, and not in a sentimental vein, I don't believe, really, but it deals with some really important issues. And it uses the characters and the bond between the duck and the man as a means to explore a lot of really crucial issues. And as she said, she wrote it after 2001. So
yeah, and I found that to be the case too. It's beautiful in the way that it doesn't preach to you. It doesn't scream out message film.
Right.
It's just intrinsic to those characters' journeys, you know. And Nick, I know that this had to have been a tough balancing act because like Mr. Hall said, it could easily veer into too much sentimentality or sappiness or preachiness. But what was the key to achieving that kind of balance when you're putting the story together?
You know, it's funny because Philip and I were talking about this because we just did a director commentary for our DVD, and I never really intellectually thought very much about it when I was writing it. It was kind of a gut emotional thing, and I actually think that's why maybe it works a bit universally in terms of I've seen it in a bunch of different countries because it's really just a human story. But I don't... I don't really, you know, now we're answering all these questions and kind of post-haste intellectualizing it, but I don't really rationalize and think that way. And we were laughing because when we just basically, like, Philip and I met, I mean, he read it, he just got it, and we never really had time or, you know, for a lot of chit-chat. I mean, it's really fun now, but it's interesting to see these things in there, and I didn't kind of consciously put them in per se. It was just based, I guess, on looking at really what's going on here at home in our society a bit. But, yeah, I mean, I'm just going to ramble on that one because I really can't put it into words.
Well, it's also refreshing because it's a film for the entire family, too, that every generation of a family can enjoy watching together. I believe, and I actually think I read an interview with you, Mr. Hall, where you were delighted to do a film that your grandchildren could watch with
us. Yes, it's hard to find a film these days that kids can watch.
Yeah, did you write this role with Mr. Hall in mind, Nick?
I didn't, but just to go back to something Philip just said, you know, we've been the kind of on the circus roadshow of film festivals and the like together, and it's
right.
been great because Philip's been traveling along with me and his family. But we did see the movie with one audience that was, like, kind of disenfranchised, cool youth, like, up around Berkeley. And it was great because they were, like, cheering for him like he was an action hero. You know, it was my two action heroes. But but to answer the question, I did not write the movie with Philip in mind. I try to really divorce myself from thinking of any particular actor when I'm writing because you can get really lazy and think of you know, all the great things they bring to the role and not write it into the character. But usually the minute I'm done with something, I'll glom on to someone in my head, and if it kills me, I'll get it to them. And that was Philip. So
that must have been thrilling when he agreed to do it.
That was a great moment. You know, there are these real highs.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of slogging through. And a lot of the times, you know, if you shoot high, that's the person who actually – really comes through and helps you because they can and they want to and they will, and that was one of those defining great moments when he said yes.
Well, Mr. Hall, were you at all scared or hesitant to take on the project? Because, well, first of all, it's obviously an independent feature. It's made on kind of a shoestring. That's just the nature of it. And two, that you do have to play most of your scenes opposite a duck. Was there any hesitancy on your part?
Well, there wasn't any. I thought about it a lot. I didn't have a lot of time to think about it, though, because actually from the time that I got the script until we began to shoot, there were only a few weeks in there. And once I said yes, I really couldn't. I couldn't have backed out even if I had wanted to. I mean, just from an ethical point of view, it wouldn't. And I didn't want
right.
to. But. So I had very little time to have any recriminations. All I had time to do, barely, was to learn the lines.
Right.
And that's what I did for the couple of weeks I had before we began to shoot. There was no time for recriminations or regrets to sneak in there. There were too many lines to learn.
Yeah, I never thought I'd ask this question, but how was it playing opposite a duck? Did you develop a rapport in a way through production?
Well, of course, as you're probably aware, when you do films with animals, there's usually more than one animal playing the role for all kinds of reasons. And so we had more than one duck. A fully grown duck of that genus looks like another duck of the same age. So you can substitute ducks because they... this type of duck, because they all look sort of the same. But it was discovered early on in the shooting that among the ducks that were available to us, and there were quite a few actually available to us, some were better at certain things than others. A certain duck listened very well. Another duck would display frustration or anger better. Another duck might move on cue more reliably. So we did have a number of ducks to use in a given scene. I think our favorite duck was one that listened well because I had to do a lot of talking and he had to do a lot of listening.
Sure, yeah.
So now, as far as developing a rapport, I was dealing with a different duck, often several ducks in the same day of shooting. So I can't talk about developing a rapport with a particular duck, but I did begin to develop some, at least, sensibility about, I don't know, duck psychology, but just in terms of handling a duck and working with the closeness and trying to give an illusion of contacting the duck and receiving some sort of intelligence back. I say an illusion because a duck is not like a dog or even a cat in that respect. Ducks do seem to be different, and of course their eyes, you know, are on the side. So when you're looking at a duck, you're really seeing sort of the sides of their eyes. So it's not a face like a face that kind of moves you like a dog's face or a cat's face,
right?
Let alone a human face. So there's a lot of, as it were, sort of theatrical ledger domain involved, I think, in working with an animal like a duck, which basically is not responsive in the way that a dog or a cat would be.
Right, right.
So, and I'm not derogating that. I'm just saying that was a fact of it. So given the fact I was working with a number of ducks, and also the ducks do not respond the same way that the domestic animals would, it was kind of a balancing act on my part. And my concern mostly, really, in the scenes that we had together, was that it looked as if we were together, that it
yes.
looked as if we belonged together, and it looked as if we took delight or comfort in each other's company. And that's what I was really working for.
And then you absolutely achieved it. And it's a credit to you because it does, the scenes do feel like you're, in a sense, playing off one another, where you could have easily been acting, across from it might have come across like you're acting a monologue across from a brick wall, but in fact, there seems to be this chemistry that kind of grows between the two of you throughout the movie.
Well, I do feel good about it, and of course, Nick, even more than I have, but we both have seen the film many, many times.
Yeah.
So I'm happy when I watch it. I mean, I believe in the belief.
Yes.
When I see it, a lot of times when you see your own movies, you kind of cringe for all kinds of reasons. Well, you feel you could have done it better, or you feel there's some false notes there. But with this film, I don't feel that. I feel that Joe and I, or the various Joes and I, with Nick as our promoter, that we did contact each other in some way, and that it's believable on the screen.
And we shot it so that, it's really the two of them within the frame, and it's not just manipulative and cheated through editing. So you
sure.
really, I mean, I think you really do get the sense that they interact. The one thing about the ducks is they are social and curious, and so those are good qualities to have as an actor.
Yeah.
That's true.
I think it's essential that you do feel that relationship and that bond, because I think the whole theme of this character's journey is, I'm paraphrasing, but a line that he has that, I like having you here because it reminds me that I'm here too.
Yes.
That's really the crux of that character's journey.
That's a notable scene in the movie too, because that's the particular scene where we bring him home for the first time, and I try to feed him, and I follow him all over the living room and the kitchen, and throw the bread down for him, and so that's a series of important moments there. But that scene, which is like 4 minutes or 4.5 minutes or something, there are no edits in that scene. That scene went from start to finish. That scene is as you see it. No green screen there or anywhere for that in the movie.
I love that.
Yeah.
Nick, tell me about the Los Angeles that you wanted to portray in this story.
Well, first let me say that I am a lover of Los Angeles. I'm a transplanted New Yorker, now a Venice girl. But basically, the society that's portrayed is, it's slightly in the future, so as to be not just kind of moaning about our times, but allow a little bit of time and hope for a change, but also not so far away to be irrelevant. But it's really speaking about a little bit where we're headed in our times now. It's kind of one where, like, social services and social graces are both gone, and, people just, it's the next presidential election, but it's kind of talking about what's going on a little bit domestically today. And just, you know, what you said, you described the film so eloquently, kind of about the disposable people and things within our society as far as are concerned.
And I see that we're probably going to see a lot more films on these themes in the future as these problems become more and more, you know, prevalent in this country. So I applaud you for tackling these issues with the film you have here. But I was another thing I was very impressed by was the music you have in this film. I mean, I am a sucker for anything Tom Waits or Leonard Cohen, and so I was in heaven watching this movie just for the music alone. How did you manage those great artists and those?
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, I love doing that part of it. I was determined not to like my temp track more than my final my final mix. So basically, I, the same way I pursued Philip, I would try to get to the artist directly. It's bookended with Leonard Cohen, and there's Eels, which is a very LA group that I love, and David Byrne, who do the songs, and then the rest of the score is original by Alan Lazar, and he's done a beautiful job weaving it all together. But for the kind of, there's a lot of silence in the film where the lyrics of the songs are almost, you know, the dialogue of the script. And
yes,
the songs weren't written for the movie, but it was really fun in editing to just try to place things and play them and see if they worked. And if I fell in love with something, I would, on a rough cut level, at least put the music in and try to get it to the artist and get a yes from them, and then it just happened to work. But those were big moments, you know. I'd forgotten what it felt like to be so nervous, you know. But when I was waiting to hear back from Leonard Cohen, I felt almost as bad as when I was waiting to hear back from Philip.
Yeah, I mean, these are icons. I mean, these are and Tom Waits is the opening song of the film, isn't it?
The opening song is actually Leonard Cohen.
What's
funny is Tom Waits is my other love, but he's not in the movie, and I fully expected and wanted him to be, but I couldn't afford it anymore, and the pieces I had tried, they didn't work as well for some reason. I'm not next one.
Well, just to give you a sense, from watching that first scene with the Leonard Cohen music and with Mr. Hall in the bedroom with the plant and I was just in tears. I mean, from the opening minutes of the film, it just moved me so much.
It's amazing to me. He's talking about his little room and the lyrics are so, yeah. I mean, it was one of those things when my editor and I placed it, we're like, that's it. And then it was just a question of, you know, trying to get the rights, and Leonard was terrific.
Mr. Hall, you've been acting for such a long time now. I'm wondering if the rewards or your reasons for doing it are the same as when you started out. Have they deepened or changed at all as the years have gone by?
Excuse me.
I'm sorry. I have the same problem. So.
I don't know. Did you hear that whistling sound?
It's gone now. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think my hopes and dreams and intentions here have been pretty consistent over the years. I started professionally when I was about 30, and I think I was hoping at that time for quick fame and quick riches on the one hand. On the other hand, I was always looking for a certain kind of material that somehow allowed us to go a level or two deeper, and in fact, I didn't really do any films until I moved to Los Angeles in 1975.
Right, right.
And I started in New York in 1960. So, and I never even thought of myself as a film or a television actor. And it was in the theater, really, that I found the kind of depth and the kind of roles and the kind of challenge that I felt I was right for.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised, actually, many, many years later when I found myself doing film and television, because in the beginning, of my career, I did not anticipate ever doing a film or any TV. I thought I would have a career as a theater actor. And it so.
Well, the film really took, the film and television both really took off. I mean, that's obvious.
Yes, my life changed significantly after I came.
Yeah, thank goodness for that. We've all been the benefactors of that. I wanted to ask you about another previous film you did, but we just got a question on the chat room, and they want to know about your creative collaboration with Paul Thomas Anderson. Obviously, it's been a very fruitful one for both of you. What is that like?
Well, I met Paul when he was a production assistant, a volunteer production assistant, on a movie that I was doing for public television, and he was just there really as an observer to watch a movie being made and to watch actors, and that's where we got to know each other, and he somewhere we were there together for a week or so on that film, and he said that he had a script with a role in it that was really good for me, but it would be more in the nature of a student film because he didn't really have any money, but he had some equipment that he had access to.
Right.
And he asked me, could he send me a copy of that script, which was called Coffee and Cigarettes.
That's
and
right.
It was a 28-minute sort of mini-drama.
Mm-hmm.
He sent me that in the mail. I still remember vividly receiving that in the mail. Just a sort of kid. I mean, he was really young then, that I met in this offhand way. And this script was like, it was unsurpassingly brilliant.
Uh-huh.
Now, as a theater actor, and by then I had done a fair amount of film and television, I had read a lot of scripts. I was also a literature major in college, and theater literature was sort of my specialty, my special interest. So I was blown away. I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, it was like, it was, I was struck dumb by the quality of the writing in this short film.
And he's only getting better, isn't he?
And I knew literally instantly, my wife is a witness, and some friends are too, whom I remember calling and reading some dialogue on the phone, as in, let me read you this first page of dialogue from a script I got in the mail an hour ago. You won't believe this. And who is it? Everybody wanted to know. And I said, it's nobody you would know yet. It's a kid. I said, but this is a genius. I mean, there was no question about it. Absolutely no question.
You're a great acting hero of ours on the show. And perhaps selfishly, I want to ask you about another hero of mine in the field of acting who you've worked with. And that's Al Pacino in The Insider.
In The Insider.
This is an actor that I study every role he does, and I honestly tell you that my favorite moment in any Pacino film takes place in a scene that you share with him in The Insider, when he goes through his very inspiring speech about corporate responsibility, and he feels betrayed when everyone in the room is against him. It's almost like a moment of total deflation.
Yes.
Can you talk to me about the experience of acting across from him and any memories you have of that scene?
Yes, you know, Al has been a particular hero of mine also over the years, and I was involved for a short time with him in a theater project in New York, which never happened. It didn't come off, but we had a few rehearsals, but I don't think he remembered that when I was cast in The Insider. It wasn't a good experience, the one from 30 years earlier, so I'm glad he didn't remember it. So we met really fresh, but I remembered it, but he didn't. But I've been a great admirer of Al. Al is a very, very great and special actor. And we had a number of scenes together in The Insider. I remember very much the one that you're speaking about. Al is difficult to work with because he works from a certain inner position, and he does not quite let you in there. I mean, it's part of how he works. It's part of what has made him the great. I mean, great. I mean, he's a great, great actor, no doubt about it. And it's part of what has made him the great, great actor that he is. But there's an area there that you can't get into when you work with Al. Now, I don't know what his feminine co-stars think in terms of more intimate kinds of love scenes and things, but I know that as a male actor working with him, that we had in some way to come together in ways, and it's very difficult. He just won't let it happen. So, it doesn't mean he's better or worse as an actor. But just watching, you know, I taught acting too, on and off over a period of years.
Yeah.
And of course, I've been acting since I was really a child, actually. So I've been at this a long time. So I'm really curious when I work, especially with some of these gigantic, especially dramatic superstars,
right,
and how they work and how they approach the work and how they are to work with. And I found Al, I found him respectful, and I found him, I would say, fraternally convivial in a way, and friendly on the set. But in terms of the work, together with him, toe-to-toe, and I had some scenes in that movie, eye-to-eye, toe-to-toe,
right, right,
with Al. And I have to say, I was a little intimidated also coming into that. And of course, I was afraid we'd have a flashback to the bad experience we had had in 1971 or whenever it was, which I don't think he did. But I was just intimidated. His, I mean, his position is just gigantic in film and film history.
Yeah.
So I was definitely intimidated a little bit.
Well,
but I say I found him respectful and convivial, but not encouraging. Let me put it that way.
Well,
he was not encouraging, and he must have seen my fear at a couple of points in our work together. So anyway, that's my short story.
Well, thank you for that. You don't know how you've made my month, made my year. Any Pacino story I could get. Nick, tell me what you want people to take away from your film Duck, and tell us how we can learn more about it, how my listening audience can find it.
Oh, thank you. I guess what to take away, you know, if you see the movie and after you've seen it, it kind of changes the way maybe you view some of the people around you. That's always a nice thing. To me, it's a little bit of a survival story about what it takes to want to survive. And it's different for all the characters in the movie, and it's different for all the people in life. But I'm always kind of blown away by people's just fight and instinct to survive.
Yeah.
Lives that you might not think you'd want to were you in their situation. And you know, here's to that. But Duck mostly is just a warning as to where we're heading in the hopes of creating a change, because I think that the two things key to survival for me are hope and possibly the ability to adapt. But you can check out the movie on www.duckthemovie.com and you can get a hold of us that way. And I think that Warner Brothers is bringing it out on demand February 4th, and the DVD will be coming out
in April?
Like a June 3rd street date. I think we've played the theaters we're going to play so far to date, and we're going to do that right now.
Well, it's a beautiful, it's such pure of heart, this film, and I can't recommend it highly enough. And thank you both so much for making it, and thank you both so much for being on our show. You're welcome back whenever you'd like.
Thank you guys for being out there. Like, it's all about the audience stuff, so it's so nice to connect with someone else through a film. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank
you both so much, Nick and Mr. Hall. Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye
now.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye, Philip.
Bye, Nick.
Man, what a great thrill that was.
That was.
Nick Bedauer, writer-director of Duck, and her star, Philip Baker Hall, one of our great actors.
Yeah, oh, one of the greatest.
We just talked to Philip Baker Hall, man.
I know. It's surreal.
I know. And what a body
Sydney's on my phone.
What's that?
Sydney's on my phone. I mean,
oh, is he
incredible.
Ready? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, just to let everyone know, we thank you for the questions you submitted in the chat room. We'll continue to monitor the chat room if you have any more questions. And we ready for our next guest?
Yeah.
This is great. And I think that
how
my
you
bronch-
feel? You sound good, by the way. You sound much better.
I feel that I am on the verge of a cough,
okay,
but I'm afraid to because it'll open up the floodgates. It's
don't
bronchitis.
Worry about it. Think how many times I coughed. I mean,
yeah. Bronchitis is really getting to me. So the movie geeks are thrilled to welcome our next guest tonight. She is a multi-talented actress, teacher, and award-winning writer. Her writing credits include the landmark series Touched by an Angel, The Christmas Wife, starring Jason Robards, Unlikely Angel, starring Dolly Parton, Angel Passing, starring Yume Cronin and Calista Flockhart, which coincidentally premiered at Sundance, and went on to win 15 awards here and abroad. 10 of her plays including Calamity Jane and On the Edge, have been produced both in and outside of New York City. And she's won a slew of awards, including the National Endowment of the Arts Award, and her instructional book on writing titled The Way of Story is taught in countless prestigious universities and serves as the basis for year-round workshops she hosts throughout the U.S., Europe, and Asia. We are truly honored to welcome this highly accomplished artist to our program, Ms. Catherine Ann Jones. Catherine, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello. Is this Jamie?
This is Jamie. It's great to hear your voice.
Yes, hi.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
I'm talking to you from rainy Southern California.
Oh, it's raining over there right now.
Yeah, cats and dogs, yeah.
I thought it never rained in sunny California.
I know. Go figure.
Your book was fantastic. I had such a great time reading it. And I wanted to ask you first about, you studied under Uta Hagen.
I did, first with Lee Strasberg and then Uta Hagen.
Oh, what was that experience like? You're talking about the two giants of the acting.
Well, they're both powerful figures. Strasberg scared me. I was very, very young and vulnerable, and I thought this man will destroy me if I stay. So I didn't study long with him, and later I came to Uta, who was wonderful because she grounded me. You know, I was doing a very ethereal, kind of ethereal acting style. I did my Shakespearean style, my Chekhovian style, and I played Ophelia once, and she said, I want you to play an Ophelia, I believe, goes to the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so shocked, you know. But it was the best thing that could have happened, because even when you're, and it applies to writing, because even if you're doing spiritual themes, as I like to do, you have to ground it.
Yeah, yeah, and that was an amazing piece of advice, and I did get that when I read it, but you said that you began writing plays partly because you're disappointed by the lack of good roles for women. Is that...
Yeah, and the new plays. And the new plays I was acting in, and, you know, you do 8 shows a week, and sometimes you spend weeks and months in a run of a show. And I realized it seemed women were being portrayed as saints or whores, and they weren't three-dimensional roles. So I thought, I can't do worse than what I'm trying out for, so I sat down and wrote my first long play, which was about Virginia Woolf. And that's the one that won the National Endowment of the Arts Award. So that
edge,
kind of
right?
launched me.
Yeah. But did you find that when you started to write that your experiences as an actress proved useful to you?
Oh, totally. It always amazes me how we do different things in our life. And we don't connect them, and then later, looking back over the decades, it's like a plan, like some, you know, very well thought out design. Because acting is the perfect background for writing dramatic, you know, for doing dramatic writing like plays or screenplays or television.
Yeah.
So I'm fortunate that, and later when I taught at the New School, I taught playwriting, I would use improvisations to teach playwriting for the benefit of those writers who never had the opportunity, you know, to be an actor. Because I think, then, it, you know, I think it, because dramatic writing has to breathe, it has to walk, it has to live, not just be left on the page.
Yeah. And you cover the craft of writing significantly in your book, from outlining to structure to creating memorable dialogue and character. But what interests me and about your book is it focuses a great deal on the spiritual or the soul of writing.
That's why the subtitle of The Way of Story is The Craft and Soul of Writing. You need both. You need an integration of both. And the soul, I consider the invisibles of writing, whether it's channeling or writing, you know, using your intuition more. And in my workshops and with my clients when I do consultant work, I try and get them to come with the whole of themselves, not just the left brain, you know, but to bring all of themselves to the
right.
table.
Yeah, because it really is about taking some of this out of your head in a way. Because
I think we go to movies in order to feel something we're often conditioned both at home and at school not to do. And, of course, we have a smorgasbord of choices of what kind of feelings we want. We can be terrified by a horror film, titillated by an erotic film, or moved by a consciousness-raising film or a love story. But I try and get my writers to really write to evoke what feeling they want. And to do that well, you have to feel it yourself first.
Yeah. Yeah,
I
thought this was interesting. Many first timers, they're instructed to write what they know, but you say that's not necessarily the best template to use.
No, I do. I know I surprise a lot of people when I say that. Of course, it's fine to write what you know, but I always cite when I taught at USC Graduate Film School. I taught screenwriting there for 7 or 8 years. It's called the Lucas Building. George Lucas gave us that building because that's where he went to school.
Right.
And I think, George Lucas never traveled in outer space as far as I know. But he imagined Star Wars, and he did pretty well.
Yeah.
So I think the criteria is not necessarily write what you know, because there are books and research to find out what you don't know. I think the criteria is write what you feel a passion for, either a theme or if it's sci-fi or outer space, whatever it is. And I think that's what will hit the gold, the pot of gold.
Yeah. Do you think you have to have a strong sense of self to be a good writer or an artist in any medium?
I think, personally, I write in order to discover myself.
Yeah.
So it's not like you have the self before you write. It's that through the process you discover what that self is more and more. So writing's the best therapy, I know, and I think it's a great spiritual thought in that too, or spiritual work.
Yeah. And it also, the reason why I ask about a strong sense of self is, obviously you build character by your failures as much or not more than your successes. And you speak to the book about the importance of failure. Why is experiencing failure important to the ultimate success of a writer?
Well, even apart from writing, Jamie, I think if you look back, where have you learned your greatest lessons? Is it by the happy, wonderful times of your life, or has it been the challenging times or the failed times?
Right.
I know I've learned my lessons during the difficult times, and it's the same way with writing. When you fail, you really learn the lesson. In fact, I never did it, but I always wanted to bring a really bad film and screen it for my graduate film students. Because when you watch a great film, you're kind of swept away, and you're just moved by the film, and you're not really objectively looking at what works and what doesn't. But when you see a bad film, it's pretty evident, what doesn't work. The structure's off, or the characters aren't believable, or, like that.
I think that's a great idea. But do you use, as it is, do you use certain films or screenplays as examples of what you teach to these classes?
Very little. I do sometimes do clips. I might do 5-minute or 9-minute clips from movies, from scenes of work to illustrate certain points. But mainly, I guess my writing workshops are revolutionary because I actually have them write. We do a series of 5 and 10-minute exercises and then bring it in for feedback. Because if I were teaching you swimming, and if I lectured on swimming for several hours, would you learn to swim?
Mm. That's absolutely
I don't think
true.
So.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But as you tour across the country and internationally with this class, do you find a common stumbling block more than any others that these young writers tend to suffer?
There are a lot of universals, so there are a lot of same things, but some things are different culture to culture. For instance, I've taught in England 2 or 3 times. And the English are better trained, I think, in syntax and their study of literature and of story structure.
Yeah.
So they have that better than Americans often. I'm generalizing, of course. But what the English didn't have as well as the Americans was being in touch with their feelings and writing from their feelings.
Mm.
So I thought that was interesting.
That's another question I had, excuse me, about the different approaches to storytelling overseas as opposed to here in the States. So you're talking about there's a difference of a perception or a depth of feeling and its importance in the work overseas than here in the States?
Well, I think the English are just much more reserved, and they would write with a little more distance, as a rule, than their gut feelings. And for instance, I just came back from teaching in New Delhi at the National School of Drama and also the Film Academy there.
Wow.
And, you know, their approach is, again, much more exterior. Like their actors are trained, like in London, you know, their school's based on the Royal Academy. So they learn how to use their voice and their body. And they don't write. So the exercises just opened a whole new door to them. They said it was like entering another world and being given themselves. Because they hadn't realized they could draw from themselves to write. And, of course, who we are and our resources are, it's a tremendous resource. In fact, I often tell my students that for those of you who don't come from a dysfunctional family, I'm sorry for you. Because there's no greater goal than drawing from those family backgrounds, dysfunctional backgrounds. It's no accident, I think, that the great dramas and novels throughout history, whether it's King Lear or Hamlet or Dostoevsky or War and Peace, Tolstoy, that they're family dramas. Death of the Salesman,
exactly.
The Glass Menagerie, Long Day's Journey into Night. You know, the best play O'Neill ever wrote was his family drama. So it's when you dig deep and expose that. When you write about what you have to write about, but you don't really want to write about.
That's just it. And you mentioned The Glass Menagerie, and that to me, that's always been my favorite play. And because it feels like just you can feel he bled over every single page. You feel his,
exactly.
His passionate.
Here's the interesting thing. I remember I was at Yaddo in Saratoga Springs years ago, and I had written about 4 plays and had some success. But I kept putting off writing the inevitable dysfunctional family play. But deep down, I knew I had to write this, if only for myself, like a kind of exorcism.
Yeah.
So I finally said, I'm going to bite the bullet. I'm going to get this play out of my system so I can then go on and write other things. And I assumed that this play would not mean anything to anyone but me. It's too specific. It wouldn't be commercial, but I just knew I had to write it. And I would just cry over it. It was based on my family growing up in Texas. And I did it about 3 generations of Texas women.
Mm.
And it's called The Women of Cedar Creek. And amazing my surprise, I won more awards for that play than any other play I wrote.
Oh.
And people would come up and say, I grew up in Canada, that's my family, how did you know? I grew up in Kansas, that's my mother, exactly, how did you know?
Mm.
And so I learned from that in the specific lies the universal and not the other way around.
Absolutely. That's what's so beautiful about
it. Chekhov did.
Yeah, that's so beautiful about the art form is the connections between people that they experience through viewing a play or reading a book, but writing as its best should be a cathartic experience for the writer, shouldn't it be?
Yes, and if it is for the writer, there's a good chance it will be for the reader or the audience.
Absolutely, and I want to ask you about something else in your book. What I particularly enjoyed, you have terrific quotes and insights from everyone from Walt Whitman to Alfred Hitchcock and William Macy, and there's tons of great insights in there. When it comes to advice, what's the most valuable piece of advice that you've ever personally received in terms of what it is you do?
Oh, that I've received. It's interesting. I've never taken a writing class, so I have, even though I've taught them for over 20 years. Well, I think Uta gave me good advice because she knocked the phoniness out of my acting years ago and grounded me, like I said earlier. And I realized to be authentic is what matters. Yeah. Now, not self-indulgent, but authentic. There's a difference that's often blurred today. So I think that commitment to authenticity is very important. So in my rewriting process, whether it's rehearsal with a play or just sitting at my desk, does it ring true? Is it believable? I don't know about you, but there's so many movies coming out today that, you know, they're very clever and they have plot twists and all that, but I don't believe. And if I don't believe a story, they've lost me in the first 10 minutes.
I am completely with you. There's so many films that don't have the conviction of spirit that you write so eloquently of. And it's all about character, isn't it? I mean, that's what you say in your book too.
Well, being a playwright, I guess I have a bias toward character-driven stories, but those are usually the best.
Absolutely. I needed to ask you before I let you go. You know, we're in the middle of a writer's strike. And,
yes, my union's on strike.
That's right. And what do you think about what do you think we're looking at? Do you think we're looking at a satisfying resolution anytime soon to this?
I don't think anything will happen until the second week of February, if then. Some people say it's going to go on long. I don't know. I'm not following it day to day, but. But, you know, it's necessary. It's long overdue. But, and I don't think the Directors Guild, the deals they cut, have helped it,
if I may say. Yeah. But isn't it understood? I mean, don't they understand that without the writers, they have nothing? Shouldn't that be an understood?
Well, you know the joke about the actress who came to Hollywood and was so stupid she slept with the screenwriter to get her.
I've heard that one, yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, in Hollywood, the creative people don't have the power. I think that's one of the problems and why we see the kinds of movies we often see.
Absolutely.
So I think that makes a difference. So it was odd coming from New York. I was an award-winning playwright, and I was so naive in the beginning when I came to Hollywood. I thought writers had power like they do in the theater.
Well, do you think that in terms of film, do you think that era existed in the 70s?
Well, it was different. I mean, in the earlier time in Hollywood, the studios had the power. Then the directors had. And I think now the agents are very powerful. So, you know, it shifts all the time. And, of course, the actors, the superstars, have tremendous power. So, you know, it shifts. I don't think the writers have ever been, I guess their day is yet to come or something. Yeah. And television writers have more power because the writers become the producers often.
Yes, and actually, if you want fantastic writing, you can easily find it on TV more than the multiplexes nowadays, it seems. So.
I think so. HBO produced my first movie, The Christmas Wife. They're on DVD now, and they gave the writers a lot of freedom, which is, you know, they honor the writing process, I think, more than other corners of Hollywood. Jim, if it's all right, I'd like to say if anyone's interested in the Way of Story workshops or the consultant work, my website's wayofstory.com.
Okay.
And I invite them to visit.
So it's the wayofstory.com?
No, just wayofstory.com.
wayofstory.com, and they can find out all the information about your book and your seminars.
The book's The Way of Story. It's in all the bookstores now, and they require it for NYU and other schools. But
I'd like
to close with a quote, if I may, since you mentioned you like quotes. David Putnam, who produced Chariots of Fire and The Mission, and he did some wonderful movies, he said to Bill Moyers once in an interview, if movies were what they might be, there'd be no need to go to church.
That's a great quote.
Isn't that it?
It's what we were talking about in our earlier segment with Mr. Philip Baker Hall, because his movie is about connections. You know, it's the connection to another being, to the spiritual side of yourself. I mean, that's really the ultimate goal of art.
What's the name of the film?
His film is called Duck. It's a little independent film. It's a beautiful little movie, and so pure of heart, and that's something you don't get a lot nowadays. But
Juno, I think Juno is up for winning the Academy Award. It's very refreshing.
Absolutely. I think so, too. Your book is fantastic, and I cannot recommend it enough to our listeners. And thanks so much for joining us tonight. Feel free to join us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. And you really read my book. This is nice. A lot of interviewers don't bother to read it.
Of course I read your book. And we have, you know, we have to come back on. I want to hear about your encounter with Norman Mailer. There's a wealth of stuff in your book that I haven't covered. But come back on anytime you'd like.
I'd love to. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That is Catherine Ann Jones. She is the author of The Way of Story and an internationally renowned instructor on the principles that she teaches in this book. A great book, a great guest, a great show tonight.
Yeah, it was. No, it was an awesome show. You did great. For someone with bronchitis, you sound pretty good.
Thank you, man. Thank you. We'll be back Sunday. I'll see what illness I can pick up by that show, see if I can overcome that.
Yeah, I know, really.
But the Sunday show, it's going to be a good one.
It's going to be a casual, round table.
The two biggest news stories this week have focused around, obviously, the Oscar nominations, which we will address next week on next Sunday show, and the sad passing of Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not a gossip show. We're not talking about what you see on the news. We're going to really provide an open forum to his fans and to fans of great acting in general, just to talk about Mr. Ledger's contribution to film, because he was a volcanic talent, and that's how we're going to celebrate him on Sunday.
That's right. No tabloid, no TMZ bullshit, nothing like that.
Yeah, disrespectful. But it's why you know, obviously his family is going through a tremendous amount of grief, as his fans are too, and I want to give an open forum to anyone with some feeling of him and his work in their heart to call and share your thoughts on Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. And we'll also be talking about Oscar nominations and reviewing the latest in home video. So, Jerry, it's been a great show.
You did a great job.
You did a great job, man. I appreciate you you being my my wingman. What is that? Is it wingman or maverick or in Top Gun? What is it?
Wingman. You want to use a Scientology term? Sure. I mean, no, but it's wingman, I believe.
All right. Well, unbeatable team, you and I, dude. Thank you so much for joining us tonight in the chat room, and we look forward to bringing you the show on Sunday night.
Yeah, have a good week, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.